The city's gangland underworld can only be policed by disciplined civic leaders, like Chicago's Orlando Wilson, superintendent of police.
Organized crime in a large city is carried on by men who are dedicated to their nefarious operations, concerned with their selfish gains, disregarding the rights of human beings, and bound by the law of the jungle.
1960. After decades of corruption, racketeering, and violence stemming from the organized crime syndicates, Mayor Richard J. Daley was pressured to hire a new police superintendent, O.W. Wilson, a reformer. Unlike the previous chiefs of police, Wilson is not politically connected, and he's not even from Chicago. But he promises to completely restructure the city's police department. It seems like the sort of decision that the machine politics mastermind like Richard Daley would never make. But he had to. A major criminal conspiracy like no other in the city's history almost ended Daley's political career. A series of high-end burglaries rocked the North Side and Loop throughout 1958 and 1959. A single gang robbed homes of valuables and furniture and looted businesses of cash and merchandise, sometimes in up to three heists a night, and often the same locations multiple times a year. As soon as one of the criminals was taken into custody in the Cook County Jail, he began to reveal just who was behind this ring of professional burglars. And it was not the crime syndicate, not one of the city's many street gangs, but officers in the Chicago Police Department. This is the story of the Summerdale scandal, a conspiracy you can believe in. Chicago, Illinois is no stranger to tales of political corruption. But the Summerdale crime ring scandal is one that I don't think we talk about enough in this city. Because at the time it happened, it was the biggest scandal in the history of the Chicago police. And it absolutely dominated the press. The scandal from the late 50s and early 60s is part of a wider issue in Chicago that's been talked about a lot this past decade, and certainly in recent months. It's a major issue before millions of Americans. How do major cities deal with corruption and abuse within their police departments? I first heard about the Summerdale scandal while reading the book Boss by Mike Royko about 10 years ago. That was a book that I used as a source for the episode on Mayor Daley and the 1919 race riot. Royko argued that the scandal nearly broke Richard J. Daley's grip on power, and it was perhaps the closest he ever came to losing control of the Chicago machine. The story of on-duty Chicago police operating a lucrative burglary ring for 2 years captured the city's attention, and it resulted in one of the most sweeping police reform measures in U.S. history. The situation in 1950s Chicago was a little bit different to the present day, but I think there's some lessons here that we can learn about police accountability and the limits of reform movements. My main source for this episode is a book by an independent journalist and crime historian named Richard Lindberg, a book called To Serve and Collect. The final chapter has a really detailed overview of the Summerdale scandal and what happened afterwards. I have it linked in the description if you want to buy it yourself. In case you were wondering, the title of this scandal comes from the name of what was then the 40th precinct of the Chicago PD, Summerdale. The precinct was redistricted, and the station was abandoned in the years after the crime ring was exposed. But the Summerdale Precinct building is still there. It's at Winchester and Foster, and if you live around Ravenswood in Chicago, you've probably walked past the building at some point. But let's take a moment to look back on what the city looked like then, in the 1950s, because it will give us some important context onto how Chicago police were able to organize a burglary ring for years without anyone noticing. A lot of people have an overly idyllic view of the 1950s, of law and order, of the prosperity of the post-war economy, And it is true that violent crime rates in America in this era were comparable to today. That is to say, they were historically low. But there's one thing when it comes to crime that makes the 1950s stand out. Organized crime and political corruption were rampant. If you know any of the stereotypes of Chicago and corruption, you'd probably guess that the Windy City was particularly bad about organized crime. And you'd be right. There was a loose confederation of associated gangs known as the National Crime Syndicate, and they had significant influence in the city by operating gambling dens, racetracks, and other black market enterprises. The city was also governed by a democratic machine whose chief concern was delivering patronage jobs to loyal operatives and voters, and not necessarily governing in a fair and equitable manner. So what did this mean for the police? Well, the first thing to keep in mind is that the organization of the police department and the expectations of the job were a little different in the 1950s in Chicago compared to today. For one, police then were not paid very well. By 1960, their wages had increased only about 10% over the course of 30 years. This meant that police officers often felt compelled to break the unenforced rule against moonlighting. Officers could find jobs in their off hours working as security guards, often for illegal gambling joints, or for the mob-run Sportsman's Park in Cicero, or as bodyguards for important figures in the criminal underworld. There were plenty of these sort of jobs to be had. What we now call River North in Chicago was, at the time, a hotbed of unlicensed bars, gambling dens, and brothels operated by the crime syndicate. Bribery of police was also widespread and understood to be part of life for the everyday Chicagoan. One example, drunk drivers who got pulled over knew to wrap their license in a wad of cash when handing it to a traffic cop to get out of a DUI. This atmosphere made it possible for crooked police, which then were a significant percentage of the force, to make a bit more than just an honest living. So-called millionaire cops were common, buying mansions in the outskirts of the city, or in high-rise condos on Lakeshore Drive, well outside the means of an underpaid police captain or beat cop. The corruption went to all levels of city and state government. For instance, one group of Republican and Democratic politicians, their party allegiance shifted depending on their business interests, were on the Near West Side, and they were widely acknowledged to be representatives of the Chicago Outfit. This was the organization that was part of what we would later call the Mafia. The concentration of gambling dens and other criminal enterprises in the West Side ensured that these aldermen always voted against any efforts at anti-corruption legislation or reform. By 1950, the junior senator from Tennessee, Estes Kefauver, attempted to raise his national profile by taking on the scourge of organized crime. He set up a special investigative Senate committee to undercover racketeering, murder, and extortion carried out by the National Crime Syndicate. In Chicago, Senator Kefauver's efforts were stymied by groups like the West Side Crime Syndicate politicians, as well as by outright acts of violence carried out by the mob against informants and witnesses. Here's just one such incident. In 1946, a Chicago gang leader and political operative named James Reagan, he's the co-founder of the Reagan's Cults, if you listen to my episode on the 1919 riot, bought a news company for publishing horse race results to compete with the local mob-run wire service. As you might guess, this caused a lot of trouble for James Reagan, who ended up being assassinated by a shotgun blast as he was driving his car down Pershing Avenue in Chicago. The officer assigned to James Reagan's murder case was a police captain named Bill Drury, a man who in the past was known for actually arresting suspects with known mob connections, something that was apparently rare enough in those days to earn cops a citywide reputation. Officer Drury built up a case against the known Chicago mobster Jake Greasy Thumb Guzik, who he believed ordered James Reagan's killing. Drury soon found the state's attorney's office against him, and he would later charge that the state's attorney coerced his witnesses into recanting their statements of seeing Guzik's men at the scene of the crime. Bill Drury's career suffered for going up against the corrupt top brass, and it forced him into an early retirement. When the Kefauver Committee began investigating Chicago a few years later in 1950, Drury saw an opportunity to get back to police work. He began jumping for any press opportunities he could find, crowing about corruption in the state's attorney office and the crime syndicate control over the city. The Kefauver Committee agreed to call him up to testify, but on September 25, 1950, mere hours before Bill Drury's scheduled appearance, two gunmen shot him dead in his own driveway as he was backing in his Cadillac. The gangland assassination of Officer Bill Drury is just one high-profile example of political corruption and organized crime in Chicago in the 1950s. But the atmosphere of a powerful crime syndicate, a corrupt local government, and a largely incompetent police force are what allowed something like the Summerdale scandal to happen. So let's get into the details of Summerdale itself. The Summerdale Police District covered most of the Edgewater and Uptown neighborhoods on Chicago's north side. Our story concerns one young man who grew up in Edgewater within the boundaries of this precinct, Richard Morrison. Morrison was a cocky, intelligent neighborhood kid who was well known to the police in the precinct, and not only because he grew up with most of them. Morrison started a life of crime early. His first arrest for theft was at age 15, and he would be picked up for possession of burglary tools or larceny throughout the 1950s. Morrison prided himself as a professional thief. He trained himself in the art of safe cracking by posing as a buyer for industrial safes in the downtown loop, learning where the tumblers were and how thick the steel was in almost every kind of model of safe, while he was pretending to shop in the showrooms of Michigan Avenue. He would practice his safe-cracking skills at his local Walgreens drugstore, and eventually branched out to other parts of the city, and even taking his safe-cracking show on the road to Las Vegas and Los Angeles before he was locked away in prison for 9 months on a burglary charge. When Morrison got home in 1957, he became engaged to be married and promised to get an honest job. And he did. For a while. While he was working as a delivery driver for a local pizzeria in Edgewater, Morrison found it almost impossible to do his job because of the excessive ticketing the local cops were carrying out on his employer's delivery cars. This was because the precinct was harassing the pizzeria with ticketing in order to pressure them into promising free food to police officers. This was a common practice in Chicago at the time, and as it turns out, many coffee shops and restaurants in Chicago that offered free meals to cops originally began the practice because of police extortion. Morrison soon found himself delivering pizzas for free to the local Summerdale police station, and he was already well known to some of the officers there, either because of his previous career or through childhood friendships. Ironically, Morrison's close relationships with the local police would be what drew him back to a life of crime. One day, while Richard Morrison was walking down Bryn Mawr Avenue, Officer Frank Faraci stopped him as he went past a liquor store. Faraci, who was heavily intoxicated, began to pressure Morrison into stealing luxury items for him and his friends on the police force. "After all," said Faraci, "we like nice things too." Morrison was sent on a mission to steal a set of deluxe golf clubs for one of the local patrolmen. He couldn't find any promising leads in the city, so he moved north to the suburb of Evanston, where he saw a set of golf clubs waiting for him inside a parked car. As he made his move to steal them, an Evanston cop opened fire, chasing Morrison in a pursuit that led him back to Chicago, where the young burglar was arrested, charged, and freed on bond. Morrison now needed a lot of money to shake his latest burglary case, and he figured the easiest way to do that would be to go in the business with the crooked cops at the Summerdale police station. The eight police officers involved in the Summerdale conspiracy included Al and Saul Karras, twin brothers that Richard Morrison went to high school with and sometimes had dinner with at their own houses. Chicago is a big city, but many of the neighborhoods are a lot like small towns. These people knew each other, and they all went way back. The Summerdale cops employed Morrison to crack safes or break into local businesses and homes nearly every night, based on immediate need of luxury items among the police force, or based on what the cops thought that they could sell for a profit. All of the planning and direction came from the police involved in the conspiracy. They would tell Morrison what to steal and when. When the World Series was coming up, they'd get him to rob portable TVs from an electronics store. Or when Al Karras wanted an outboard motor for his boat, he'd goad Morrison on to rob a marine mechanic shop. The heists went on almost every night for over 2 years. It's hard to estimate just how much in value the Summerdale burglary ring stole. Morrison, keep in mind, was a professional. He knew how to crack almost any kind of safe. He knew how to get in and out of buildings, and he carried custom tools for cat burglary, including a homemade rope ladder and a gun with armor-piercing bullets for opening up particularly tricky safes. To ensure no one was caught on their heists, the police accomplices would patrol the target businesses or the home while Morrison broke into the location and then brought the haul to a waiting squad car. After a successful burglary, the Summerdale cops would gather up to divide the plunder between them, and sometimes in the presence of their wives. These heists happened almost nightly at around 1 a.m., with the police selecting targets and Morrison choosing the methods of entry. One location, Western Tire and Auto, was hit several times over the course of 2 years. And although Morrison was a professional cat burglar who did his best not to get caught, the behavior of his police accomplices sometimes made his job difficult. On one of the many raids on Western Tire and Auto, one of the Summerdale cops roared past the business on a three-wheel motorcycle, frightening Morrison and almost attracting the attention of potential witnesses. After a while, the thrill of the robbery seems to have clouded the judgment of the Summerdale police, or perhaps it was the greed. As they expanded their turf of burglary targets across the north side and into Rogers Park, they took on riskier ventures. In October of 1958, they even carried out an armed robbery of a jewelry store on Wabash Avenue in the Loop. Though the burglars were masked, a nearby traffic cop wrote down the plates of the getaway car and traced the vehicle to Patrick Grork, an officer at the Summerdale station who was in league with Richard Morrison. Officer Grork claimed that his car was in the repair shop after an accident, and somebody probably stole his bumper and license plate in the process. Somehow, this got the police off the trail of the Summerdale 8 for at least another year. The Summerdale police grew more bold with every job. Eventually, they would be doing more than just providing lookouts for their resident cat burglar. One night, the Summerdale cops broke into a shoe store on Devon Avenue and walked out with $14,000 worth of merchandise, which they then attempted to sell at a nearby bar for $2 a pair. Morrison recounted the getaway from this particular heist, being driven away from the scene of the crime by a policeman who was dead drunk and giddy from unloading the stolen merchandise at the bar. To quote Morrison, "Everybody around the tavern was talking about him selling the shoes. He was a real nut. He was wild. He wanted to do anything for money." At one point, the Summerdale cops even offered to outfit Morrison with a policeman's star and a uniform, which the burglar declined. It's hard to tell what's more surprising, that the police in the burglary ring took so long to eventually get caught, or that Morrison stayed working with them for years. Not only were the Summerdale police harsh taskmasters and incompetent crooks, they were double-crossing Morrison the entire time. Throughout his work with the Summerdale ring, Morrison would occasionally be picked up by detectives from the Northside Bureau. He'd be taken in for questioning on the recent burglaries in the area, and only let go after offering a bribe. As it turns out, his friends in the Summerdale precinct were tipping him off to their friends in the Detective Bureau. This allowed the detectives to make a little hush money on the side, and it let the Summerdale police have an extra bit of leverage on Morrison to ensure that he'd continue to keep his mouth shut. But it gets even worse for the cat burglar. Eventually, Morrison became suspicious, not without reason, that someone in the Summerdale station was trying to kill him. While breaking into a business on Lawrence Avenue, someone took a pot shot at him. Morrison would always suspect that it was his police lookout, and he would select his partners on heists carefully from then on. The gravy train could not roll on forever for the Summerdale ring. On June 30, 1959, a pair of non-burglar police officers arrested Morrison while he was out on bond for another run-in with the law. Morrison was brought into the Cook County Jail, where he had time to think about his place in the burglary ring and how he'd been taken advantage of. He wasn't going to take the fall for a bunch of crooked cops. After all, didn't they get their detective friends to harass him for bribes? And didn't one of them even possibly try to kill him? Richard Morrison was fed up with his co-conspirators. He decided to snitch. Morrison was looking at up to a 20-year sentence. So he sent word to state's attorney Ben Adamowski that he would be willing to reveal all the sordid details of his burglary ring in exchange for immunity or a reduced sentence. Adamowski was at first uninterested, but when Morrison began naming names of several police officers in Uptown and Edgewater, the state's attorney's office changed course. Some important context. Ben Adamowski was an up-and-coming Republican politician in Illinois, and he wanted nothing better than to blacken the eye of the Democratic machine in Chicago. Adamowski had recently been a Democrat, and he lost in the party primary for mayor against Richard J. Daley in 1955. Weakening the image of Mayor Daley as a modern, forward-looking mayor who completed major infrastructure projects would do wonders for Adamowski's career. He would then go on to run as a Republican and lose against Daley for mayor in 1963. Either out of civic duty or because he saw an opportunity to scandalize Mayor Daley, Ben Adamowski agreed to knock off 20 counts of burglary from Morrison's case if he agreed to cooperate with the investigation on his former conspirators. Morrison provided a deposition that was 77 pages long. The papers would soon call him the Babbling Burglar. Adamowski took extreme, probably improper measures to build his case against crooked cops in Chicago. He set up a top-secret investigation of the Chicago police, which he oversaw personally, and eventually planned a midnight raid on all the Somerdale suspects with a crack team of detectives on January 15, 1960. In all, 4 truckloads of stolen merchandise were taken out of the homes of the Somerdale burglar policemen that night. One of the cops involved was a man named Officer Peter Beeftink, and he was described by his own lawyer as, quote, a stupid policeman. Detectives raided his home that night and found an expensive brocaded chair. Beeftink panicked and invented a story about buying the chair from a retired officer in Florida, which was easily disproved. As it turns out, Beeftink was not one of the main conspirators, and he was given the chair by the other police in the burglary ring when he accidentally barged in on them while they were dividing up the loot. The other Somerdale cops did not consider Beeftink competent enough to take full part in the ring, and he would get off with a $500 fine, suspension, and no jail time. The others were not so lucky. The trial of the Somerdale 8 was an electrifying story in Chicago in the early 60s. It was a conspiracy of policemen working with a professional cat burglar to rob dozens of homes and businesses clean out for over 2 years, and it went uninvestigated and unpunished until now. Mike Royko put it this way, quote, the public was genuinely shocked. It's one thing to take a few bucks to overlook an illegal U-turn, but even Chicagoans could become indignant at the thought of policemen jimmying the locks of appliance stores and loading up their trunks. On city time yet. The trial itself was probably entertaining on its own to warrant attention from the press. Julius Eklus, a locally famous loudmouth mob lawyer, served as the defense counsel, howling and theatrically accusing Richard Morrison of being a criminal mastermind bent on tarnishing the record of the honest Somerdale cops. Morrison played his part well, taking the stand and pretending to be a shy young man in over his head, meekly answering the questions as defense attorneys tried and failed to paint him as a dangerous psychopath. In the end, all 8 of the accused Somerdale police suffered some form of penalty. All were at least suspended, and their punishments ranged from $500 fines to up to 5 years in prison. But the story of the crime ring doesn't end with the guilty verdicts at the trial. It had long-lasting political effects. The Somerdale scandal shook Mayor Daley to the core. Some reporters claimed that he was drinking far more heavily than usual, showing up to morning press conferences red-eyed and in a foul mood. For possibly the first time in his life, Daley felt his place in the political universe of Chicago slipping away. The Somerdale scandal had legs. People were outraged. Unless he did something, it could destroy him. Daly needed a scapegoat fast, and he found one in the form of Tim O'Connor, the long-serving police commissioner who had been in charge of the Chicago police for over a decade. O'Connor, like all of the police top brass, was a political appointee, but he was widely regarded as an honest cop, even if many of his underlings weren't. Still, Daly had to find somewhere to pin the blame for Summerdale. Daly told reporters, quote, "Tim was always telling me how he went home at night and watched TV instead of running around getting into trouble. I should have asked him why he wasn't running around checking on his policemen at night instead of sitting at home watching TV." The city government quickly set up a committee to find a new commissioner. After less than a month, the committee selected one of its own members, O.W. Wilson, to lead a new, reformed police department. Daly and the city council approved the decision in March of 1960. As I said at the top of the episode, O.W. Wilson does not seem like the type of person a man like Richard J. Daly would select for leadership. Wilson was bookish, a criminology professor in the University of California system, and he wasn't from the city. He briefly served as Wichita's chief of police after he left his native South Dakota. Before 1960, most high-level appointments in the Chicago Police Department were the result of machine politics. Though there was a civil service exam system, rising in the ranks of the Chicago PD was more likely to be based on who you knew rather than what you did. It was an organizational structure that encouraged looking the other way from corruption or bribery within the force, and it didn't exactly reward reform-minded police brass for rocking the boat. Losing the police department as a body that relied on the good graces of the democratic machine was a sacrifice that Daly had to be willing to make. And changes did happen, swiftly. Some of the immediate reforms that Wilson was able to carry out were cutting down the number of precincts and redrawing their borders so they would no longer coincide with the city council ward boundaries. In theory, this meant that local police captains could be more independent of pressures from local machine aldermen. As part of his modernization plan, Wilson turned police headquarters into a buzzing nerve center of communication and activity. A new computerized system kept track of cases and statistics, and dispatch centers were beefed up with new equipment to cut down on the sluggish police response time to emergency calls. Wilson also ramped up the use of new squad cars instead of walking beat cops for patrols, and the vehicles were painted with a still signature light blue and white, with the motto, "We Serve and Protect." Another major reform that Wilson introduced was a meritocratic system for promotion and career development, as well as an internal affairs division to investigate corruption. Many black police officers, who had previously been assigned foot patrol duty and segregated from white police officers as a rule, would later trace their promotions or recruitment to Wilson's reforms. One such officer was Renault Robinson, who would go on to found the Afro-American Patrolmen's League and would then serve as the director of the Chicago Housing Authority under Mayor Harold Washington, the city's first black mayor. Before Wilson became the superintendent of police, the new title for commissioner, policing was seen both by members of the force and the public at large as just another job, and one mostly for white men. There was not a widespread level of respect afforded to officers beyond any other commonly held job in working-class neighborhoods. Even Richard J. Daly would describe the job of police officers in his youth as just people who, quote, wanted to beat you over the head. The bribery didn't help much to boost the image of the police among everyday Chicagoans either. What O.W. Wilson did, ultimately, was to professionalize the Chicago Police Department. He gave them better equipment, higher wages, new training, and higher standards to hold themselves to. And it is true that open police bribery on the level of the 1950s became largely a thing of the past. Wilson also took federal desegregation rules seriously and went out of his way to promote black officers within a police force whose mission was widely understood to include isolating and harassing the black community. All of the fallout from the Summerdale scandal led to the police department that we know today, a modern, professional force with strict rules and standards that it holds itself to, at least on paper, with an internal investigative structure. And I'll be brutally honest here, it hasn't worked. Although O.W. Wilson attempted to make the Chicago police a colorblind institution built on meritocracy, shocking incidents of police brutality on the city's black population have shown that many in the department still view their job as an almost military occupation of the majority black neighborhoods of Chicago. The money that O.W. Wilson directed toward the dilapidated Chicago Police Department in 1960 has now ballooned to an unsustainable level, with the police now taking up over 40% of Chicago's city budget, with no signs of any serious redistribution to schools or medical services. What's worse, countless scandals occurred after O.W. Wilson's reforms, even ones that were more shocking than the Somerdale scandal, including the police riot outside the Democratic National Convention in 1968, or the case of Commander John Burge, who tortured hundreds of innocent men in custody over the course of 20 years, or the police murder of teenager Laquan McDonald in 2014 and its subsequent cover-up. I don't want to use this show to make explicit calls to action, but if you live in Chicago, I urge you to contact your alderman to support the Civilian Police Accountability Council, or CPAC. Events like Somerdale and the numerous scandals that occurred after Wilson's reform make it clear that the police in Chicago are incapable of policing themselves. CPAC is not a toothless proposal. It means an elected civilian board being given the ability to appoint or fire police superintendents, negotiate the CPD union contract, and to hold the final authority over police board policy and disciplinary measures. I'll include a link in the description of this episode to give more information on how you can support the CPAC ordinance if you live in Chicago. Now as an epilogue for our story, whatever happened to Richard Morrison, the babbling burglar who exposed the ring of robber police in the Somerdale precinct? Shortly after the Somerdale trial concluded in 1961, Morrison packed up and moved to Florida, but he was called back a year later to testify about a doctor who treated him for a gunshot wound sustained while he was robbing businesses for the Somerdale gang. Prosecutors wanted him to divulge information about Dr. Leonard Macaluso, who was known to have some ties to the Chicago outfit. The babbling burglar was on his way to Chicago's Criminal Courts building at 26th Street and California to testify when a speeding car zoomed through the intersection as he was about to cross the street. A shotgun barrel emerged from the window in the back seat, and it blew Richard Morrison down, nearly severing his arm. Miraculously, Richard Morrison survived. An ambulance was on the scene immediately, though he demanded his lawyer ride with him, as he was too afraid to be left alone in the vehicle with police. After Morrison left the hospital, he finally made it to the witness stand, where he apparently forgot every last detail of Dr. Macaluso, or where he was treated, or any details about the mob. The state's case fell apart. After that, Richard Morrison moved to Florida for good. There is a rumor that he got a job as a police photographer, of all things, in Fort Lauderdale. But beyond that, nobody has any clue what happened to him. It's possible that he could be alive today. We just don't know. After the events of the Somerdale scandal, Richard Morrison appears to have deliberately dropped himself off the face of the earth. Can you blame him? Thank you for listening to this episode of Conspiracy You Can Believe In. Once again, the main source for this episode was Richard Lindbergh's To Serve and Collect, which I have linked in the description. In the coming week or the next, I'll release a bonus episode that's tangentially related to the Somerdale scandal, involving a group of young radicals in the Uptown neighborhood who had several run-ins with the Somerdale precinct. It was a group called the Young Patriots, and they were a group of Southern white migrants who organized with the Black Panthers and the Young Lords to protest police brutality from Somerdale precinct cops, as well as many other social justice issues of the late 1960s. It's a fascinating story. Can't wait to get it to you. Thank you.